Let's talk sports. This is Kent Batty, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona, and I'll be reading to you today from the USA Today Sports Weekly for March 18th. But much of this particular issue of this paper is devoted to fantasy baseball. There are pages and pages of fantasy-related baseball statistics, player by player, that sort of thing. That doesn't translate too well to the radio broadcast. So I'll be reading a few short articles from that. But since this is the first full day of the NCAA March Madness tournament, I thought I'd start with an essay with regard to that tournament. So here we go. This article is from ESPN News, their sports team, obviously. The headline is, Coaches Predict the Men's NCAA Tournament Champion, Potential Cinderellas, and More. It's written by Jeff Borzello. Much like last season, the true national title contenders have separated themselves into a tier of their own, entering the 2026 NCAA tournament. Arizona and Michigan established themselves in the opening weeks of the season, and Duke definitively joined them after beating the Wolverines in Washington, D.C. back in February. And similar to last season, Florida has surged in the SEC play and has emerged as a clear threat to repeat its title. In 2025, the tier break between the favorites and everyone else resulted in all four one seeds reaching the Final Four for the first time since 2008. Will that happen again? A repeat of that is statistically unlikely, but those four teams, the top four at KenPom, Bart Torvik, and in the NET, with the most quadrant one wins in the country, were the only ones to receive multiple votes to win the national championship in our annual poll of 25 coaches and scouts. The official vote tally reads this way. Arizona got 12 votes, Duke got 5, Michigan 3, Florida 2, and Houston, Purdue, and UConn each got 1. We also asked the coaches about the strength and potential flaws of the top four contenders, whether St. John's or UConn has a deep run in them, the championship viability of preseason number one Purdue, and whether four trendy Cinderella picks can really make a run, and how far star freshmen can carry their teams. So here are the top four contenders. The Arizona Wildcats. Strengths. Arizona received the most votes to win the title after its run through the Big 12 tournament. The Wildcats are dominant in the paint and on the offensive glass, and they rank in the top five nationally in both offensive and defensive efficiency. Tommy Lloyd has a deep, balanced unit with clutch late-game shot makers in Jaden Bradley and Braden Burries. When you play Arizona, you have to be ready for a heavyweight fight, one coach said. They're so big, so physical, so strong at every position. There's no softness to them. There's no quit to them. They just keep their heads down and keep playing. It's like an old school bully. When it's over, they've just physically ripped you. I think they have all the components, another coach added. They have experience and leadership. Bradley has been to the Final Four. Braden Burries is a top 20 pick. And they've got pros out there. They have a way to win that's a little bit different, a little unconventional, but they've really bought into that. On a one-day prep with the physicality they play with, I think that's going to help them a lot. Potential fatal flaw? It's perhaps the most obvious of any of the one seeds, but it hasn't really hampered the Wildcats this season. They rank last in the Big 12 in three-point attempt rate and percentage of points from three-pointers, sliding in at number 332 overall with just 5.9 three-pointers made per game. That's the biggest thing, one Big 12 coach said. Let them take and make as many threes as possible. You'll eliminate the paint stuff, but now you've got to rebound the missed shots. Long shots means longer rebounds, and they're coming off higher. Krivas, Awaka, Pete, and Karchenkov Burries, Bradley, they're all going to go after the basketball and with physicality. Another Big Coach agreed with that assessment, a Big 12 coach agreed with that assessment, adding that teams need to force the Wildcats to play in the half court, then make them beat you from the perimeter. You have to be able to take care of the basketball, he said. They're sneaky defensively. They turn you over, and they're so good in transition. You end up giving 16 transition points, and you're looking at it like they dominated us 8 feet and in, and they also scored 16 to 24 transition points. Next are the Duke Blue Devils. Their strengths, coaches and scouts who picked Duke pointed to one reason, National Player of the Year favorite Cameron Boozer. Boozer was the winningest, most decorated high school basketball player in modern history, and his winning ways haven't changed in college. He's the best player I've ever coached against in college basketball, one ACC coach said. Nobody has a matchup for him. He does everything. He scores in the post, unbelievable rebounder, can make threes, terrific IQ and passer and creator. Handles the ball in ball screens, and literally nobody, maybe outside of Caleb Wilson, who plays for Carolina, is a good matchup for him in the country. This is a classic Duke team, another coach said. They didn't go after the most talent. Shire went after talent that fits. It's not just a bunch of guys out there. It's the guys that are about the right things, playing for each other. As a coach, you'll love it. It matters. It matters when it's a tight game. Potential fatal flaws, injuries to Caleb Foster and Patrick Gongba pose the biggest questions entering the tournament. Foster suffered a fracture in his foot earlier this month and is unlikely to be available for at least the first 2 weekends, and Gongba has been wearing a boot on his foot and hasn't played since March 2nd. There's more optimism surrounding Gongba, but both being out would set back the Blue Devils. There's a lack of depth now, one coach said. Without Gongba, it puts them down at 6 plus Darren Harris. That could hurt because it's a mix of not making enough shots to give Cam Boozer and space, and then just purely from a numbers perspective. It's a bigger problem if Boozer ever gets into foul trouble. He's going to have to play 35 minutes a game after Siena, which is the first round game. They were better than last year with Pat and Foster. I don't know if they are now. Duke has an elite defense, ranked number 2 nationally in adjusted defensive efficiency, but the Blue Devils did show some vulnerabilities in the ACC tournament without Foster and Gongba. Florida State had huge success against them for the second time this season, and Virginia scored 1.1 points per possession in their game. You can put Boozer in isolation situations, especially against guards that can attack off the dribble. Give your guards as much space as possible and make it really hard to sit in the gaps, one ACC coach said on how to beat Duke. You hope to create advantageous situations, but it also makes him guard every possession. And if he has to guard every possession, you're hoping he's worn out. Next are the Wolverines from Michigan. Strengths. Michigan appeared to be the prohibitive favorite this time last month, steamrolling every team in its path while looking like one of the most dominant teams in recent memory. Then the Wolverines lost to Duke, lost L.J. Kaysen to injury, then lost to Purdue in the Big Ten tournament. But with their size and depth, several coaches were not dissuaded from picking them. They probably have the most balanced roster, one Big Ten coach said. In order to win a national championship, you got to win games in multiple ways. They can play big, they can play small. They can get in a shootout, or they can win a game where they lock down and defend. I hate using this word, but Yaxel Lindeborg is something of a unicorn in college basketball, another coach said. He's 6'9", he can guard wings, he can dribble, pass, and shoot. He can pick up guards full court. It makes them extremely different. Ade Mara is 7'3 and can clean up. The first line of defense is a long-limbed guard, then the second line of defense is a 7'3-er. They switch everything. Morris Johnson Jr. can guard guards. It's overwhelming. But there are potential fatal flaws. Like Duke, Michigan's biggest issue entering the tournament is an injury. Kaysen suffered a season-ending torn ACL in late February, and while he technically came off the bench, he was a game-changer for Dusty May's team. Kaysen averaged 8.4 points, but was becoming an increasingly important factor as the season progressed, scoring 18 against Northwestern, 13 against UCLA and Purdue, and 14 against Minnesota, impacting momentum when he was on the court. It also allowed May to mitigate some of Elliot Cadeau's inconsistencies. There were some games that Cadeau played only 18 to 22 minutes with Kaysen jump-starting the Wolverines. He was the cheat code for them, one Big Ten coach said. They're losing his shot creation. If you watch in Big Ten play, for instance, LJ could score 18 and lift your team. Against Northwestern, he comes in and starts kicking ass and goes on a scoring run. You have to have a guard to go off the bounce and get you a good shot. He was that guard, and that could go get it for you. Wisconsin also might have demonstrated the blueprint for how to beat Michigan, with the Badgers winning in Ann Arbor and then taking the Wolverines to the wire in the Big Ten tournament. In those two games, Wisconsin made a combined 31 three-pointers, while Michigan made only a combined 16. The Wolverines can make threes, but they can be prone to getting outshot and outproduced from the perimeter. It's a consistent perimeter shooting, and then on the defensive end, that's the one thing they're susceptible to, a Big Ten coach said. You got to be able to make threes against them. If they give up 12 threes in a game and they only make 7, which can happen, that's a 15-point swing against a good team in an NCAA tournament game. And next to the top four is the Florida Gators. Their strengths? Can Florida go back-to-back for the second time in the past 20 years? Some coaches believe a repeat title is possible. After starting the season 5-4, losing their first game in conference play as well, the Gators lost only once over their final 17 games, winning 13 of those by double digits. It always starts and ends with their front court, one coach said about the trio of Thomas Howe, Alex Condon, and Ruben Chinyelu. That's what's going to carry them. That's where they're elite. As good as Michigan is and Arizona is, and they are tremendous, Florida is just as good, if not better, with the depth that they have. They scored 72 points in the paint against an SEC opponent. That's their core. That's who they are. Chinyelu developed into, for me, a real case to be the player of the year in the SEC, an SEC coach said. His dominance from rebounding, defending, scoring on the interior, physical presence, he took a whole different leap this year. And Haw, they turned him into a legit wing. His shot-making ability really helped their perimeter game. Those two guys have really grown. But there are potential flaws. Florida was playing as well as any team in the country over the final 2 months of the season, riding a 12-game winning streak that was ended by Vandy in the SEC tournament semifinals. The Gators are still very much a threat to go back-to-back, but their 324th nationally ranked three-point shooting percentage reared its head against both Vanderbilt and Kentucky in the SEC tournament. They won a combined 8 for 37 from 3. It's perimeter shooting as a whole, one coach said. To me, they've only got two guys that have consistently made shots. Haw has been decent. Klavzar, off the bench, has been good. The other guys have been, at best, inconsistent. It turns into a different type of game when they're not hitting shots. They have to play faster. They have to force more turnovers. They have to beat up teams on the offensive glass. Their defense has to be elite. They can still win games. It's just harder. Though their front court might be better than it was last season, their back court doesn't have a Walter Clayton Jr. to bail them out. I don't think this team is as good as it was last year, an opposing coach said. That team had three guards that got drafted, and their best player was Walter Clayton. That team was really, really good. This team is too, but that one was a different level. Now I think I'll shift down to the bottom of the article and read what they think about potential Cinderellas. And the first one they mention, of course, is number 11, Miami, Ohio Redhawks. The case for Cinderella. Their number one thing is confidence level, one MAC coach said. They're the most confident group I've seen. They really have good pieces. They're selfless. They share the basketball. They have multiple guys that can step up and score 20 points on any given night. They don't depend on one or two guys. Elmer and Suter can both do it in late games. When it comes down to crunch time, Suter is going to have the ball in his hands and they'll run their flow chin series. The pace stats surprise me. I just think they're very efficient. When they beat Akron, it was 76-73. They were efficient. And by the way, Miami won its first round play-in game against SMU. But the case against Miami, their biggest deficiency is defense, a MAC coach said. They've had 6 or 7 one-possession games, and they probably should have lost 4 or 5 of them. Their interior is very thin. If you can get Antoine Wolfolk in trouble, they struggle when they go to the bench in the forecourt. Next is South Florida Bulls. The case for them is Cinderella. They rebound at such a high level, especially for us, one American Conference assistant coach said. They depend on those extra possessions. They spread you out, and then Nelson down low, he's such a difference maker. You think you've got an advantage down low with size, but he's so quick-twitched that he can do many things defensively. It's a huge key they have. I have no doubt he'll have success against Louisville, to be honest with you. He can have success against size and athleticism, especially if you can't put pressure on their offensive boards or you don't rebound it well. They're extremely efficient at getting out and getting to the rim. They spread you so quick and they can make shots with several different guys. But the case against them? As good as they are on the glass, if you can dominate that aspect of the game, you'll definitely have an advantage. That's been the key to which teams win their games, the glass. Louisville's shooting can cause problems, especially if South Florida is aggressive in their ball screen coverage. A lot of teams have issues getting out of their aggressive traps. They can turn you over left and right with their coverage. But if you got a good point guard, you can get it out and get them stretched and find open shots on the backside. People are going to underestimate how hard they play. But you can get them collapsed, you can get paint touches, and spray out threes. Here's another Cinderella, Akron Zips. They were the best team in our league because of their depth and the way they dominated, said one MAC coach. They're unselfish, and they added a high major piece in Evan Mahaffey. He's a Swiss Army knife. He does a lot of things really well. He's a long defender. He can guard 1 through 4 or 1 through 5. They have 3 guys on the bench that can start for anyone in our league. Tavari Johnson is a high major guard. Shomo Scott would be a high major guard. Sharon Young comes off the bench and plays 18 minutes a game and doesn't flinch. He could play 30-plus on any other team. Winning helps, but everyone on their team has accepted a role. The case against them, their interior defense isn't great. They're not very deep at the 5. I think a team who gets out in transition, one that can score in transition, will hurt them, a MAC head coach said. Akron is going to switch a lot on the perimeter. Texas Tech's ability to make threes could be a problem, but it depends where they get them from. If they're playing from inside-outside or they're getting out in transitions, that is where we'll hurt them. And one last Cinderella, the Northern Iowa Panthers. They're a totally different team when they're fully healthy. It was known that they were getting hot at the right time, a Missouri Valley assistant said. They're a very disciplined team. Defensively, they're really, really good. They're still in the top 25 at KenPom. Ben Johnson has always been an unbelievable defensive rebounding coach. They're always top 25 in the country. Because they don't turn it over on offense, they rebound the hell out of the ball. He really values possessions. They protect the paint, but they contest threes at a really high level. They'll make you shoot threes, but because of their length and closeout discipline, they really contest those threes. Trey Campbell has great size at the mid-major level. He can really shoot it, really pass it. Leon Bond is a glue guy. He's athletic. He can score at the rim, defend anyone on the court. And Max Weisbrod can really shoot it. Tristan Smith was an unbelievable portal pickup for them, one of the hardest playing guys in the Valley. He's an awesome defender. He gets fouled a ton, When he went out, they won 2 of 8 games. They do have a quiet confidence about them. 11 guys returned from last season. But you have to find a way to get into the paint, a Missouri Valley coach said. They quick hedge, but you need your point guard to come off the ball screen and turn the corner, be aggressive. Your bigs got to roll really hard, put pressure on the defense, otherwise you won't touch the paint. You can get a little bit off ball action. It's definitely possible. St. John's has better athletes than them. Can they offensive rebound? It's really hard, but they can be efficient if they find a way. Okay, I may have worn your ears out on the NCAA basketball tournament, so I'll switch back to the Sports Weekly and start with some of these baseball stories. The leading off story this week is from Steve Gardner, and it's about trends to watch and strategies heading into the 2026 season. The 2026 MLB season is nearly upon us, and I'm once again reminded that it's always a good idea to have your fantasy draft as close as possible to opening day. No one wants to see one of the players they drafted injured before the first lineup block, and you certainly don't want to have one of your outfielders suspended for the season before it even starts. But we, as industry analysts, make those mistakes by drafting early so you don't have to. As you read through the annual Fantasy Extra issue, we'll try to highlight some trends and strategies that can help you win your leagues. One of the most exciting things about this season is the wealth of talented young players getting an opportunity to shine. Baseball HQ's Chris Blessing ranks his top 15 rookies in a later article. Yes, expectations are incredibly high for the likes of Connor Griffin, J.J. Weatherholt, Kevin McGonigal, and others, some of whom haven't played in their first major league games. But the allure of getting a Nick Kurtz in the reserve round, as RotoWire's James Anderson did last year, or an Augustin Ramirez for $2, as NL champ Matt Cederholm of Baseball IQ, rather HQ, did last year, can be incredibly difficult to resist. In addition, there's a bumper crop of young pitchers who saw limited action in the majors last year, but showed tremendous promise. Cam Schlitter, Trey Yesavage in the AL, Nolan McLean, Chase Burns, Jacob Mizrowski, Bubba Chandler, and Cade Horton in the NL all look like they can be significantly contributing in their fantasy role. If you were captivated by the thrilling exploits of Team Italy at the World Baseball Classic, you no doubt saw Royal slugger Vinny Pasquantino and Jack Caglione make major noise with their bats. Generally, it's unwise to put too much weight on statistics from a small sample such as the WBC, or spring training, or even the previous postseason, but there's a more concrete reason to be bullish on these two. The Royals have changed the outfield dimensions at Kauffman Stadium, moving the outfield walls 9 to 10 feet closer to home plate everywhere but in straightaway center, and reducing the wall height to 8.5 feet. The K wasn't overly pitch-friendly last season because its vast outfield allowed considerably more doubles and triples than the average major league park. The new dimensions will likely turn a decent number of those doubles off the wall and long flies into homers. Pasquantino, one of the leaders in pulled air rate, that's pulled balls that aren't ground balls, last season when he hit 32 home runs, should be a major beneficiary. Caglione, another one of those exciting young players entering his first full season, could thrive in a smaller yard. So, too, should established sluggers Salvador Perez and Bobby Witt Jr. One of the biggest mysteries from last season has to be the out-of-nowhere steals numbers from Juan Soto and Josh Naylor, two of the most unlikely 30-30 players in baseball. Soto came into the season with a career high of 12 stolen bases, but after joining the Mets, he ran wild by swiping 38 bases in 42 attempts and tying the Pirates' O'Neill Cruz for the most in the National League. Naylor has one of the slowest sprint speeds in the game, but but his incredible instincts on the bases allowed him to go 30 for 32 in steal attempts. Wow. MLB made several rule changes 3 years ago to make stolen bases a larger part of the game, and it's worked. Overall steals totals over those 3 years are higher than they've been since 97. Whether Naylor or Soto continue to run at the same pace as last year will have a significant impact on their fantasy values. Perhaps an even more intriguing question is who might be the next formerly slow-footed slugger to join the club? Alex Bregman, anyone? Another major rule change will be implemented this season with the introduction of the automatic balls and strikes system, referred to as ABS. There's an interesting strategic element regarding the use of those precious challenges. Unless the game is hanging in the balance, it's really only worth challenging a ball strike call if the batter is good enough to potentially change the game during that at-bat. If great hitters, especially those with impeccable command of the strike zone, think Soto, Schwarber, or Aaron Judge, could get some called strikes flipped to balls, it can only make them even more dangerous. Could this be the reason so many industry experts are flirting with or outright embracing the stars and scrubs drafting strategy? It may not be a conscious reaction to ABS, but some correlation does seem possible. Finally, if there's one piece of advice I'd like to offer for the new season, it's this: try something different. Tout Wars founder Ron Chandler has a new book out titled Fantasy Reconstructed, in which he offers dozens of different variations and rule changes that can make not only fantasy baseball, but other fantasy sports more important or more enjoyable. Even if you don't alter the basic rules of your league, you can still throw a wrinkle in your own strategy. This year's LABR Mixed Auction offers a great example of thinking outside the box. Justin Mason, one of the hosts of Fangraph's The Sleeper and the Bust podcast, pulled off one of the most extreme draft strategies in fantasy history by going all in on offense, literally. Mason started the auction by rostering the first player nominated, Aaron Judge, for $49. He followed that up with an identical winning bid for Shohei Ohtani. By the end of the draft, Mason had all $1 pitchers, with Ohtani in the ninth pinching slot. It's a strategy that dates back 3 decades and was named for its creator, Larry Labadini, who drafted 9 $1 pitchers in NLABR and nearly won the league. Like Labadini, Justin will need to make some major trades to make his Mason singlet strategy pay off, but we already know it can be done. You can bet he'll have a tremendous amount of fun trying, which is exactly the point. Now for that story about 15 promising rookies. This is by Chris Belsing. The 2026 rookie crop is deep, offering a little bit of everything for fantasy managers. At press time, it appears several bankable fantasy prospects are favorites to break camp with their respective teams. Even some of those who won't break camp will offer significant value to fantasy squads in 2026. Since playing time has a huge impact on our rankings, the rookies appearing on this list are players we believe will have a greater opportunity to produce and even end up on the opening day roster with prominent roles for their respective clubs. So here they are. A combination first baseman, third baseman Sal Stewart with the Cincinnati Reds. Stewart made his MLB debut last September, slashing .255, .293, and .545, with 5 home runs and in just 55 at-bats. This line came after he slugged 20 homers and hit 34 doubles across upper-level affiliates. Stewart, who's 22, had his breakout season fueled by a higher hard contact rate and a willingness to sit middle in to slug pitches over the left field fence without compromising his natural opposite field gap approach. He should produce more of the same, likely as the Reds' starting first baseman. Next is shortstop Connor Griffin with Pirates. Allowed 25 season across 3 levels, propelled the 19-year-old to the top spot on nearly every prospect list this winter. The ninth overall pick from the 24 draft, Griffin destroyed minor league pitching in his debut, slashing .333, .415, and .527 with 21 home runs and 65 stolen bases. Griffin's hit, power, and speed tools should carry him to impactful production in most fantasy formats. Next is Nolan McLean, a right-handed pitcher with the Mets. A former two-way player, McLean, who's 24, dazzled in his late-season big league debut in 25. In 48 innings, McLean went 5-1 with a 2.06 ERA and a 1.042 whip and 57 strikeouts. Not bad for someone who became a full-time pitcher in June of 24. McLean throws a kitchen sink assortment of pitches, relying more on overall stuff and movement than precise command. Next is an outfielder, Justin Crawford, with the Phillies. Crawford, the son of former Major League All-Star Carl Crawford, posted his best season in the minors last season in Class AAA, slashing .334, .411, .452 with 7 home runs and 46 steals. The 22-year-old improved his ability to elevate the ball, though he'll still likely turn in high ground ball rates. Defense and speed are his carrying tools. With likely a solid average, Crawford's ability to swipe bases will sustain high fantasy value. Next, as a first baseman and third baseman, we have Minnetaka Murakami with the White Sox. The White Sox signed Murakami to a 2-year, $34 million contract after a successful career in Japan. A slugger by trade, the 26-year-old is known for his pristine plate discipline, his exceptional hard contact rates, and his dismal contact rates. Despite struggling with injuries in 25, Murakami still slugged 22 home runs in 56 games with the Yasult Swallows. Actually, I think that's Yakult, not Yasult. A third baseman in Japan, he is slated to be Chicago's opening day starter at first. Next is right-handed pitcher Bubba Chandler, also with Pittsburgh. Like McLean, Chandler is a former two-way player who committed full-time to pitching after the 22 season. The 23-year-old had an up-and-down season in AAA before a late-season promotion to Pittsburgh. He left his struggles with command in the minors and proved his stuff, especially his high-riding fastball against big-league competition. Next, we have outfielder Chase DeLauder from Cleveland. DeLauder has the tools to be a significant fantasy producer. The 24-year-old has been a fixture on the injured list dating back to before he was a first-round pick in the 22 draft. When he's on the field, he has dominated. In 138 career minor league games, DeLauder slashed .302, .384, and .405 with 20 homers and 40 doubles. Then we have second baseman shortstop J.J. Weatherholt with St. Louis, the Cardinals, that is. The seventh pick in the 24 draft, Weatherholt has a tremendously high floor. The 23-year-old is known for his double-plus hit tool, which overshadows the rest of his tool shed. Last year, he slashed .306, .421, and .510 with 17 home runs and 23 steals and nearly as many walks as strikeouts. The sneaky power and sneaky speed should play right away. And then we have third baseman Kazumu Okamoto with the Blue Jays. The 30-year-old Okamoto, like Murakami, is not really a prospect, though he is an MLB rookie, having come over from Japan. With the Yomiuri Giants last year, he slashed .327, .416, .598 with 15 homers and an injury-shortened season. Power production likely doesn't follow Okamoto to the big leagues, but the hit and on-base tools should play. Then we have outfielder Dylan Beavers with the Baltimore Orioles. Beavers enjoyed a breakout 25, mostly spent at AAA before a late-season promotion took him to Baltimore. The 24-year-old slashed .304, .420, and .515 with 18 home runs and 23 stolen bases in 94 games. Beavers' ability to get on base is his calling card, but his double-plus speed doesn't carry exceptional stolen base skills. His average power should play in the big leagues. Next is shortstop Kevin McGonigal with the Detroit Tigers. McGonigal's hit tool is exceptional, which carries his profile. But don't sleep on his power, which is plus. In 88 games, McGonigal slashed .372, .462, and .648 with 19 home runs, walking 59 times, and only striking out 46 times. The 20-year-old has struggled with injuries the last three seasons and has yet to appear in 100 games. Then there's outfielder Carson Benj, New York Mets. The Mets drafted the former two-way player in the first round in 2024. Benj had a stellar season, showing the ability to work the gaps. In 116 games across three levels, Benj hit .281, .385, .472 with 15 homers and 22 steals. The Kansas City Royals have Carter Jensen, who's a catcher. Jensen's an offense-first backstop who rode loud contact rates to his big league debut in 25. The 20-year-old hit .290, .377, .501 with 20 home runs across upper-level affiliates and continued to show on-base skills and power during his MLB debut. He and Salvador Perez likely split reps between DH and catcher in 26. And the Orioles have a catcher by the name of Samuel Basayo. The 21-year-old Basayo was overmatched during a late-season big league call-up after bullying minor league pitching. It's a double-plus power tool, fueled by exceptional bat speed and feel for barrel. Basayo is still figuring out launch angles, though. The hit fuels batting average with a chance for more. And then Toronto Blue Jays have Trey Yesavage, a right-handed pitcher. The unexpected hero of Toronto's American League championship run, Yesavage will be splitting innings with one of the deepest rotations in baseball. His split finger is a true double-plus offering, especially when commanding his flat-angled fastball. Even the slider is capable of getting whiffs. Now, here's a short article relevant to the just-completed World Baseball Congress, when the loaded American baseball team decided to stop hitting and ended with a 3-2 loss to the team from Venezuela. Anyway, here's the article by Bob Nightingale. Major League Baseball players have made their voices heard throughout the World Baseball Classic, expressing their desire to play in the 28 Olympics. And it's possible that the players' union could reach a deal with MLB permitting players to participate independent of their new collective bargaining agreement. Bruce Meyer, executive director of the Players Association, fully believes that MLB will impose a lockout when the current CBA expires on December 1st. But he said March 15th that a deal could be reached before December 1st, permitting MLB players to be in the Summer Olympics, being held in Los Angeles, for the first time. Then again, everything changes if a lockout wipes out the entire 27 season. If we don't have a season, Meyer said before the USA Dominican Republic World Baseball Congress, our classic semifinal, we're not going to play in the Olympics. Time is of the essence, and Meyer realizes that the Olympics would like to have a decision this summer if possible. It can be on a separate track, Meyer said. Theoretically, it can be done any time. It doesn't have to be at the same time as everything else is negotiated. I mean, it's been kind of on a separate track anyway, the discussions that we've had to date with the league. So it could be discussed during the course of bargaining, but it doesn't have to be tied to bargaining. There still are logistical problems to overcome with the Olympics following the All-Star Game, which would be a 10-day layoff. What do the other players do during the break? Would they play exhibition games against their minor league affiliates? Who pays their expenses? Who pays for the Olympians' insurance? There are myriad potential problems, but both sides are optimistic a solution can be reached. There are a lot of issues that still need to be worked out, Meyer said, so I don't know about before the CBA, which is likely to not be until over a year from now, but theoretically it can be done. Providing, of course, the 27 season stays largely intact. If we're in a situation where games are being missed, and in 27 that could have an impact on playing in the Olympics after that, but for now it's on a separate track. Still, after watching the popularity of the WBC and the players' enthusiasm for the tournament, Meyer hopes the WBC becomes a permanent fixture in the MLB, where it likely will be played every 4 years. The WBC is fantastic, Meyer said. The fan engagement has been terrific. I mean, that's obvious. It's great baseball, great players, it's a great thing for the sport, and it's been a tremendous success. The players that I've spoken to are thrilled to be here, thrilled to be representing their countries and having a good time. It's a great thing for the league, and in this market, in Miami, you can see the fan interest in baseball, which unfortunately is perhaps not maximized by the franchise here. It's been a great thing. Let's go back now and catch a couple of short stories on March Madness. This one is by Blake Topmeyer, whose headline is 8 Burning March Madness Takes. Madness awaits. Good luck as you try to spot the perfect 12v5 upset pick so you can lord your Cinderella splitting skills over your buddies. If you'll allow me a word of advice as you fill out your brackets, I like the upset potential of the 11 seeds this year much better than the 12 seeds. Here are 8 burning thoughts and predictions off of this NCAA tournament bracket. Duke is the number one team, but Arizona is the front runner after a good regional draw. The Blue Devils earn the number one overall seeds, but big whoop. Their prize? Getting placed into a region that includes an all-star cast of coaches. Lined up in Duke's way are Dan Hurley, Tom Izzo, Bill Self, and Rick Pitino. That's some kind of reward for the tournament's top seed. As if Duke hadn't absorbed enough bad luck already with a recent injury to point guard Caleb Foster, now it's got to solve a who's who list of coaches. The true seeding affirms Duke's East region has the best collection of number ones through four seeds. Duke already played and beat Michigan State and Kansas in the regular season. That doesn't mean it would relish a rematch. Even Duke's second round game, potentially against Ohio State, brews a recipe for trouble. The Buckeyes are hot, and they can hang with premier teams. They recently beat Purdue, and they gave Michigan a 40-minute fight in the Big Ten tournament. In fact, Duke might prefer to teleport into the West region, where Arizona is the number one seed. With Duke facing the region of doom, Arizona should be viewed as tournament frontrunners. Arizona already emerged as on top of the nation's best conference. Now the Wildcats must exorcise some postseason demons. They last reached the Final Four in 2001, with a bundle of flops since then. Better to face old demons, though, than face the teams in Duke's way of the Final Four. Miami, Ohio deserved its bid. Mid-majors give the NCAA tournament its irresistible flavor, and the committee got it right by awarding at-large bids to 10th-seeded Santa Clara and 11th-seeded Miami of Ohio. The committee directed the Redhawks to a first-four game. That's fine, considering their poor strength of schedule. Kicking Miami out of the bracket entirely, though, based on a single loss, would have been too heavy-handed. Nobody snubbed. March Madness expansion unnecessary. If we needed more proof that the NCAA tournament does not need to expand, we got it. The first two teams left out of the field were Oklahoma at 19 and 15 and Auburn at 17 and 16. When we're spotlighting a 15-loss team with barely a top 50 net NET ranking as the biggest snub, that means there were no snubs. First round upset special, number 10 Santa Clara beats number 7 Kentucky. It must have been painful for Big Blue Nation to watch John Calipari and Arkansas win the SEC tournament. Well, that'll be nothing compared to the outrage that'll radiate from Kentucky if Mark Pope falls in the first round to cap his second season. Santa Clara can pile up points, and Kentucky specializes in falling behind before trying to mount furious rallies. Santa Clara finished as the West Coast Conference's runner-up. In Kentucky's last taste of the WCC, it lost to Gonzaga by 35 points in December. First round upset special, part 2. Number 11, VCU beats number 6, UNC. The Tar Heels' Final Four potential absorbed a gut punch when top scorer Caleb Wilson suffered a season-ending injury this month. That's reflected in North Carolina's seeding. If Wilson was healthy, UNC probably would be more in the vicinity of a 4 seed. VCU has won 16 of its past 17 games. Its credentials include a November rout of Virginia Tech, a 19-win team from the ACC. A frequent NCAA qualifier, VCU last sprang a first-round upset a decade ago. Dust off the glass slipper. Second-round game I'm dying to see. If chalk holds in the first-round games in Portland, Oregon, then number 3 Gonzaga would face number 6 BYU in the second round. That's an opportunity to see one of the nation's best pure scorers, BYU's A.J. DeBenza, go against one of the nation's best defensive teams in Gonzaga. Some NBA draft experts expect DeBantis to be selected with the number 1 pick. Before that, enjoy his college curtain call this March Madness. Big 12, Big 10 represent the Final Four. The SEC earned the most bids, but the Big 12 is the nation's best conference, and I expect it to represent till the end, with number 1 Arizona and number 2 Houston reaching the Final Four. I've also got number 1 Michigan and number 3 Michigan State in the Final Four. Arizona starts a lineup full of double-digit scorers. Houston has an excellent blend of proven veterans and premier freshmen. Michigan plays the nation's best defense and scores plenty too. As for Michigan State, trust March Madness virtuoso Izzo inside the rough-and-tumble East region. National championship pick, Arizona beats Houston. In the year of the freshman, Arizona starts 3 really good ones, including top scorer Braden Burries. But, as the saying goes, old guards win in March. I'm all in on Arizona because of its do-it-all senior point guard Jaden Bradley, the Big 12 Player of the Year and the soul of the team. Mitchell Northam has written us a story on the women's tourney. Upsets happen in the women's NCAA tournament much less often than they do in the men's. A double-digit seed has never made the women's Final Four, and the sport doesn't really have a true iconic Cinderella story to lean on like the men have with 2006 George Mason or 2011 VCU or 2018 Loyola Chicago. But upsets do happen. Long before UMBC became the first 16 seed to beat a number 1 seed in the men's tournament, it happened on the women's side in 98 when Harvard, led by UConn star Sarah Strong's mom, Allison Feaster, upset Stanford. Even more recently, the 23 tournament saw 2 number 1 seeds lose on their home floor in the second round. Number 8 Ole Miss defeated Stanford, and number 9 Miami took down Indiana on their way to a magical run to the Elite 8 for the first time in program history. That same season, South Dakota State beat USC in the first round. Toledo defeated Iowa State, and Princeton upset NC State. Last year's tournament featured a Richmond win over Georgia Tech and a win for South Dakota State over Oklahoma State. At the mid-major level, Carl Smesko built a team at Florida Gulf Coast that regularly upset teams in the NCAA tournament before he left for the WNBA's Atlanta Dream. The Eagles won their first-round game over a Power 4 opponent 4 times between 2015 and 2023. So the brackets still get busted in the women's tournament. Here are 5 teams to consider when looking at potential upsets this year. First is Fairfield. The Stags are in their 3rd consecutive NCAA tournament under 4th-year coach Carly Tybalt-Dudonis. Each year, they've climbed up 1 seed spot and are slotted at number 11 this season, taking on number 6 Notre Dame in Columbus. Fairfield is powered on the court by the duo of Katie Lamoureux and Megan Anderson, who both average north of 16 points per game. For Fairfield, the key number is 11.4. That's how many 3-pointers the Stags make per game this season, which leads the nation. The Stags also rank 4th in effective field goal percentage with a 55% mark and 19th in points per 100 possessions. While Notre Dame is powered by two-time All-ACC Player of the Year Hannah Hidalgo, the Irish aren't all that good at defending shooters. They rank 296th in field goal defense, 198th in three-point defense, and 272nd in effective field goal defense. The Irish are 6-7 this season when an opponent makes at least 6 3-pointers. That sounds like trouble to me. Iowa State. What version of Iowa State is going to show up at the tournament? The one that defeated Iowa in December and then won at Texas Tech by double figures? Or the one that lost to Cincinnati and BYU? When the Cyclones are both healthy and playing their best basketball, they look like a team that can beat anyone. Audie Crooks has looked unstoppable in the paint at times this season. Jada Williams has proved to be a sharp three-point shooter, and Addie Brown is a versatile player and sharp passer who complements both. If Iowa State is playing up to its full potential, there's a possibility it could give UConn a scare in the second round. And don't we all want to see Crooks versus Sarah Strong? If the Cyclones are off, they could get blown out by Syracuse in the first round. Gonzaga. Minnesota needs to be wary of both teams on the other side of its opening week pod. Ole Miss is an uber-athletic team that won some tough games in the SEC this season and has a resume that features a pair of wins over Vanderbilt. But first, Ole Miss has to get past Gonzaga. No stranger to March Madness success, the Bulldogs have been to the Sweet 16 twice since Lisa Fortier took over from Kelly Graves in 2014. This season, Gonzaga ranks second nationally in three-point shooting, making attempts from beyond the arc at 39% clip. The Zags are also third nationally in total rebounding rate at 57.8%. Typically, strong shooting plus good rebounding equals success. Gonzaga is also armed with three players everyone should know. Allie Turner is the nation's third-best three-point shooter with a 46.7% success rate from beyond the arc. Lauren Whitaker, a freshman, is the only player in the nation who averages at least 19 points and 10 rebounds per game while shooting better than 50% from the floor and 80% from the free throw line. And Inez Betancourt is a UConn transfer who has proven to be a versatile contributor for the Bulldogs. Oklahoma State. The Cowgirls have been inconsistent as they've lost to teams like St. John's and Kansas State, but swept Iowa State and notched victories over Texas Tech and Colorado. Still, J.C. Hoyt has one of the deepest benches in the country, with five players who average double figures in scoring, and a sixth, Amari Whiting, who averages 9.9 points per game. Oklahoma State also has five players scoring better than 30% from beyond the three-point line. Oklahoma State's defense has been questionable at times, but they do a great job at keeping their opponents from grabbing their own misses, ranking fourth nationally in offensive rebounds allowed per game. The Cowgirls rank in the top 30 nationally in most shooting metrics and have scored at least 80 points 16 times this season, and they're undefeated when they do that. If the Cowgirls' offense is clicking, they could cause Princeton and UCLA some real problems. Last is Western Illinois. This is a case where one player has the potential to wreck an entire bracket. Mia Nicastro is a 6'2" senior guard for the Leathernecks and the Ohio Valley Conference Player of the Year. She's fourth in the nation in scoring with 24.2 points per game and also ranks 12th nationally in defensive rebounds per game with 8.8. She's a near 50-40-90 player, shooting 52% from the floor, 38.8% from three-point, and 89.5% from the free throw line. The native of St. Charles, Missouri, also ranks fifth nationally in win shares and seventh in PER. Sorry, fans, whatever PER is. Nicastro has topped 30 points in six games this season. She's proved she can fill up the stat sheet against the major conference opponents, too, scoring 20 points against Iowa earlier this season. She will be at the top of the scouting report for North Carolina in its first round. Unbelievably, fans, there's actually an NHL article in here. It's fairly short, so I'm going to close with that reading. It's by Mike Bream. The end of the NHL regular season was about 1 month away, and there's a lot to be decided. No team had clinched, and no team has been officially eliminated, though the Vancouver Canucks are getting close. The scoring race looks like it might come down to the wire, and the playoff field has a chance to look radically different from last season. As of the morning of March 16th, 8 teams that were sitting in a playoff position, the Sabres, the Penguins, the Islanders, the Bruins, the Red Wings, the Ducks, the Mammoth, and the Sharks, had missed the postseason in 24-25. Some of those teams are looking to end lengthy playoff droughts. Here are the questions to be answered before the regular season ends. Can the Buffalo Sabres end their playoff drought? It sits at 14 seasons, an NHL record, but the Sabres lead the Atlantic Division with 15 games left. The closest non-playoff team is 9 points back. It would take a major collapse for Buffalo to miss the playoffs again, but the Sabres show little signs of doing that, going 30-6 with 2 ties since December 8th. A big reason for the turnaround was the firing of general manager Kevin Adams and the promotion of Jarmo Kelekainen on December 15th. The new general manager took steps at the trade deadline to keep the run going. After defenseman Colton Parayko vetoed a trade, Kekalainen pivoted to defenseman Logan Stanley and Luke Shen, plus forward Tanner Pearson. Shen and Pearson have won Stanley Cup titles, important for a core making a rare step into postseason play. Can the Red Wings end their playoff drought? Their situation is precarious. They hold a second wildcard spot in the Eastern Conference, but have played one more game than their closest pursuers. The Columbus Blue Jackets are surging since making a coaching change to Rick Bowness and sit 1 point back. The Red Wings are one in a 1-3-2 slide and are without forwards Dylan Larkin and Andrew Kopp. 8 of their final 15 games are against non-playoff teams, including the Columbus Blue Jackets on April 7th. Detroit, which last made the playoffs in 2016, added David Perron and Justin Falk at the deadline. Will we see another Oilers-Panthers final? Doubtful. The 2-time defending champion Florida Panthers have been crushed by injuries, including captain Alexander Barkov tearing his ACLU on the first day of training camp, and Matthew Tkachuk not playing until January after hernia surgery. And with the team sitting 11 points out of a playoff spot, it's been resting other banged-up players. The Oilers are in a good position for a third consecutive run to the final. They currently sit in a playoff spot, though Leon Draisaitl left the game on March 15th with an injury, and I think he's out for the year now. He was hit by Nashville Predators' Ozzie Wiesblatt, came back for one shift, and didn't feel well, so he missed the rest of the game. And who will win the Central Division title? Early in the season, the answer was easy, the Avalanche from Colorado. They had only 2 regulation losses on January 1st, and that figure is now up to 12. Gabriel Landeskog and Arturi Lehkonen are out with injuries. Meanwhile, the Dallas Stars are on a franchise-record 15-game point streak and are only 3 points back. The teams meet on Wednesday the 18th in Denver, and both teams have beefed up at the trade deadline. And that's going to have to do it for this week's reading. Once again, this is Kent Batty, volunteer reader with Sun Sounds of Arizona. Thank you for listening.